About a decade ago, in a spring season much like this, while Dave and I and our boys were living in Switzerland, we woke up one very normal Sunday morning. We got in our car, we drove down the mountain to go to church. We lived way up in the Alps, and we had to drive down to Lake Geneva, to a small town around the lake, to go to church, a little Anglican church in a beautiful stone chapel. We got there, we slid into our pew. The boys were little enough at that point that Dave and I could see over their shoulders. Not true anymore. And we're kind of getting situated. The pastor gets up and says, "Happy Mother's Day." And I look over at my boys and a wave of shock and horror and guilt and maybe shame washed over all of them in a few seconds. We had no idea that it was Mother's Day. So I'm starting here partly to say, if you forgot it's Mother's Day, grace upon grace to you. You can get through it. You can survive this. Your moms will survive it. And only a few hours later did we realize, because we were worshiping in a Church of England, Anglican Church, their Mother's Day date is very different than ours here in North America. It's during Lent. So we were so confused. We just thought, what's happening? This is a small example of feeling upended and disoriented, and that only for a couple hours. But we have all known much darker days and shadowed seasons where we feel like, what day is it? Where am I? The disciples are about to experience some days like that in the passage we just heard from John 15. In fact, they're either still at the Passover table together, what we call the Last Supper, heavy with conversation and betrayal and symbolic acts of all sorts, or perhaps they're walking toward Gethsemane when Jesus utters these words, "I am the true vine." Very familiar words, especially if you've been in the church a little while. But did you know that the words right before it, also from Jesus' mouth, were, "Come now, let us leave." So it could be that Jesus said, "Come now, let us leave. Let's get out of here. Let's go." And then thought, actually, let me share a few more things with you before we're all dispersed and walking along. Or it could be that this little band has gotten up, left the upper room, and were walking towards the Garden of Gethsemane when he said this. Some scholars even mention that they probably would have passed by the temple and seen, if not paused under, the enormous architectural sculptures of vines and grapes that adorned the temple. Either way, this is where Jesus takes the conversation at this point. Vines. You can imagine the taste of wine still in their mouths. Jesus has just offered them a cup of wine, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." So he tells them his blood will be poured out for them. He's articulated it clearly several times at this point. He's going to suffer. He's going to die. He's going to leave them. But we know from all the gospel accounts that the disciples are confused about all of this. They're not quite heartbroken yet because they don't seem to get it. And I wonder if their imaginations are cracking up a bit. You know, is blood poured? What? Where are you going? Is this literal? So what does Jesus say in this moment? Whether they're still reclined at the table or they're walking along the way, Jesus gives them a metaphor. He speaks to their faculty of imagining. He knows that in this confusing, desperate moment, what we call his farewell address, what his friends need is a renewed imagination. They need something beyond what can only be seen with their eyes. And so he says, "I am the true vine. And my Father is the gardener." And with that, a world begins to open up in the shrinking, cramping, fearful insides of the disciples, and they see in their mind's eye something green and growing and someone tending that growth. Jesus awakens their imaginations. And he's done that for me too, in some desperate moments. Where God is love and he works everything out for good, those fall flat. And I've needed to hear, he will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. And for Dave, I know God has met him in the words from the prophet Joel. That God will restore the years the locusts have eaten. And maybe this morning you needed to say, your name is higher than the rising sun. Of course, if you know the scriptures at all, you know they are full of symbol and simile and metaphor. God communicates himself and tells his story to us, not just as a rational download into our thinking minds, but as an appeal to, and in Christ, a redemption of our very imaginations. Let me be clear what I mean when I use the word imagination, or as clear as I can be in a short homily. I'm not talking about make-believe. Like when a kid tells you about their little pet that they've made up that's walking along beside them, and we say, what a wild imagination. I'm talking about that God-given faculty that enables us to form new ideas and to access images and concepts that aren't immediately available to our senses. Let me say that again. This is what I mean by imagination. That God-given faculty that enables us to form new ideas and to access images and concepts that aren't immediately available to our senses. You experienced your own imagination when I spoke about the disciples, either at the table or walking along the streets of Jerusalem. Whether you've been to Jerusalem or not, you had access to a scene, an image inside of you. That's your imagination. Malcolm Guite has done a lot of work considering this God-given faculty, imagination. In his book, Faith, Hope, and Poetry, which I think is his doctoral thesis, but there's a more readable version of a lot of his work in this little wonderful book called Lifting the Veil, Imagination and the Kingdom of God, which I believe were his Lang lectures at Regent College in Vancouver a few years ago that were then expanded and made into this book. And he's writing about Jesus in particular, appealing to our imaginations. And he talks about Jesus appealing to our imaginations in the parables, maybe obviously, but also Jesus appealing to and redeeming our imaginations through his miracles. And he says this. This is not to say that the gospel is in any way imaginary, in the dismissive sense of unreal or untrue. On the contrary, it is so real and so true that we need every faculty of mind and body, including imagination, to apprehend it. In an age of linear one-level readings of the word and the world, we need to recover confidence in the baptized imagination as a truth-bearing faculty. Jesus appeals to and awakens our imaginations to tell us the truth about who he is. And not just in this one saying, I am the true vine, but in seven different I am metaphors in the Gospel of John that we have been reading aloud and hearing sermons touch on here at Church of the Cross for a few weeks now. Jesus seems to be claiming, I am, first of all, in a way that was reserved only for Yahweh and is indeed what got him executed. But he says more than that. He's saying more than something of a revelation of the Trinity, that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. He also says, I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the gate of the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way and the truth and the life. I am the true vine. All of these are part of God's astonishing self-disclosure in the person of Jesus. And in the final one, we are actually invited in, this one I'm talking about this morning, in a unique way among these seven. Jesus says, I am the vine, and you are the branches. Only in this one of the I am statements does he say, here's who I am, and here's who you are, in light of that. The poet in me really wants to resist explaining this metaphor. You know, when someone asks, so what exactly does it mean to be the branches and for Jesus to be the vine? I want to say, well, a metaphor says something which cannot be said in any other way. That's the artistry of it. Or as Jeremy Begbie writes, when Robert Schumann, the composer, was asked to explain a difficult etude he had just performed, he sat down and played it a second time. But because this isn't a poetry class and it's a sermon, and because Jesus is generous to reveal himself to us, I'm going to resist the temptation of just continually saying, be the branches. What does it mean? Be a branch. How do I be a branch? You got to be a branch. I'm going to avoid doing that. I'm going to say a few things about how we abide in the vine, how we remain in the vine, how to be branches. That word that's translated in English as abide or remain is repeated 11 times in these seven verses. And if you read through it and you make yourself say the word abide or remain in a really weird voice every time it comes up, you will be hit with how many times it's said over and over again. I'm not going to do that for you, but you can go do that on your own. Abide is the command to the branches. That's us. Abide in him, remain in the true vine. Beth Moore wrote a wonderful book a few years ago that's really a long biblical theology of vines. It was not marketed like that. It was marketed more like an almost self-help book, but I've read it, I love it, I've read much of it more than once. It's actually a long biblical theology of vines and vineyards, and tracing those threads all through the biblical narrative. It's called Chasing Vines, and I cannot recommend this book enough. I love it. Just ask my triad how much I've talked about it. She seems to be a person who can work out metaphors in a way that doesn't flatten them out and tends to give them room to breathe, and I really love that about her. And she says one thing in particular about, I am the vine, you are the branches. That has stayed with me and has affected my imagination and hopefully my living. She quotes a commentator who says the Greek word translated branch emphasizes the ideas of tenderness and flexibility. She writes this, at the risk of oversimplification, maybe abiding doesn't require deep analysis. Perhaps all I need to ask myself at the moment is whether or not I am still tender, still flexible. At times, I am neither. The branch that snaps easily is either dead or stuck in a long past winter. Tenderness and flexibility. She goes on to talk about the former vine in the biblical narrative. We cannot miss that there is a rich, ancient, biblical understanding of the vine as Israel. as the nation, the people of Israel, as well as the land. The Bible seems to speak about both as the vine. Jesus doesn't use this metaphor out of the blue. And in fact, all seven of them have a long, beautiful history in the big biblical story. But the vine is Israel, first of all, in the Bible. And the vine is the land of Israel that God himself planted and tended and pruned and eventually supplanted, uprooted. The prophets warn of it being utterly destroyed, being done. So when Jesus comes on the scene calling himself the true vine, he's saying, now the vine is not the nation, not the land, not the city of Jerusalem, not the descendants of Jacob. There's a new covenant, a new cup, a new vine, new wine. Again, Beth Moore says, a conscientious Israelite hearing Jesus say, I am the true vine, would balk, saying, this is our homeland. And Jesus' response, now I am your homeland. Abide in me. And for us, here, now, anything else or anyone else or any place else that you look to be your vine, will be bereft of the power to anchor, oxygenate, and animate you the way the Spirit will if you abide in him. You heard the passage from John 15. Jesus doesn't just give us this metaphor to do its work on our imaginations, and in the metaphor, a command, abide in the vine. Jesus also gives us a promise. If you abide in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. This isn't a time when we're being commanded to be fruitful. Like in Genesis, when God tells the first humans, be fruitful and multiply, and is in fact something of what we're celebrating today on Mother's Day. Here, Jesus simply says, you will be fruitful if you abide in the true vine. He's not talking about children here, but the fruit of a life where Jesus is relied on like oxygen. That is fruit that will last. We cannot bear fruit unless we remain in him. We could spend months preaching on this theme alone, this promised fruit. I'm not saying that's a suggestion as a sermon series, but it's a possibility. But what I do want to suggest to you here is that you go and spend some time with Jesus in John chapter 15. Let these words work on your imagination so that a renewed imagination won't just stay inside of you, but could bear fruit in renewed living. May it be so.